hear a moan. "My God, not you too, Dormouse." It was the voice of Buck Titus, and with him as prisoners were Truman Webb and Dan Wilgus. Dan was in handcuffs because he had fought so. The four men were too sore to talk much as they felt the truck lurch away and they were thrown against one another. Once Doremus spoke truthfully, "I don't know how to tell you how ghastly sorry I am to have got you into this." And once he lied when Buck groaned, "Did those blank blank hurt the girls?" They must have ridden for 3 hours. Doremus was in such a coma of suffering that even though his back winced as it bounced against the rough floor, and his face was all one neuralgia, he drowsed and woke to terror, drowsed and woke to his own helpless wailing. The truck stopped. The doors were opened on lights thick among white brick buildings. He hazily saw that they were on the one-time Dartmouth campus, headquarters now of the Corpo District Commissioner. That commissioner was his old acquaintance, Francis Tasbro. He would be released. They would be freed, all four. The incredulity of his humiliation cleared away. He came out of his sick fear like a shipwrecked man sighting an approaching boat. But he did not see Tasbro. The MM's silence, save for mechanical cursing, drove him into a hallway, into a cell which had once been part of a sedate classroom, left him with a final clout on the head. He dropped on a wooden pallet with a straw pillow and was instantly asleep. He was too dazed, he who usually looked recordingly at places, to note then or afterward what his cell was like, except that it appeared to be filled with sulfuric fumes from a locomotive engine. When he came to, his face seemed frozen stiff. His coat was torn and foul with the smell of vomit. He felt degraded, as though he had done something shameful. His door was violently opened. A dirt-clotted bowl of feeble coffee with a crust of bread faintly smeared with oleomargarine was thrust at him, and after he had given them up, nauseated, he was marched out into the corridor by two guards just as he wanted to go to the toilet. Even that he could forget in the paralysis of fear. One guard seized him by the trim small beard and yanked it, laughing very much. "Always did want to see whether a billy goat whisker would pull out or not," snickered the guard. While he was thus tormented, Doremus received a crack behind his ear from the other man, and a scolding command, "Come on, goat! Want us to milk you? You dirty little so-and-so! What you in for? You look like a little kite tailor, you little..." "Him!" the other scoffed. "Nah, he's some kind of a half-eared hick newspaper editor. They'll sure shoot him, sedition. But I hope they'll beat hell out of him first for being such a bum editor." "Him, an editor? Say, listen, I got a swell idea. Hey, fellas!" Four or five other MMs, half-dressed, looked out from a room down the hall. "This here is a writing fellow. I'm going to make him show us how he writes. Look it." The guard dashed down the corridor to a door with the sign "Gents" hung out in front of it, came back with paper, not clean, threw it in front of Doremus and yammered, "Come on, boss. Show us how you write your pieces. Come on, write us a piece with your nose." He was iron strong. He pressed Doremus's nose down against the filthy paper and held it there while his mates giggled. They were interrupted by an officer, commanding, though leniently, "Come on, boys, cut out the monkey shines and take this blank to the bullpen. Trial this morning." Doremus was led to a dirty room in which half a dozen prisoners were waiting. One of them was Buck Titus. Over one eye, Buck had a slatternly bandage which had so loosened as to show that his forehead was cut to the bone. Buck managed to wink jovially. Doremus tried, vainly, to keep from sobbing. He waited an hour, standing, arms tight at his side, at the demands of an ugly-faced guard, snapping a dog whip with which he twice slashed Doremus when his hands fell lax. Buck was led into the trial room just before him. The door was closed. Doremus heard Buck cry out terribly, as though he had been wounded to death. The cry faded into a choked gasping. When Buck was led out of the inner room, his face was as dirty and as pale as his bandage, over which blood was now creeping. The man at the door of the inner room jerked his thumb sharply at Doremus and snarled, "You're next." Now he would face Tasbro. But in the small room into which he had been taken, and he was confused because somehow he had expected a large courtroom, there was only the ensign who had arrested him yesterday sitting at a table, running through papers, while a stolid MM stood on either side of him, rigid, hand on pistol holster. The ensign kept him waiting, then snapped with disheartening suddenness, "Your name?" "You know it." The two guards beside Doremus each hit him. "Your name?" "Doremus Jessup." "You're a communist." "No, I'm not." 25 lashes, and the oil." Not believing, not understanding, Doremus was rushed across the room into a cellar beyond. A long wooden table there was dark with dry blood, stank with dry blood. The guards seized Doremus, sharply jerked his head back, pried open his jaws, and poured in a quart of castor oil. They tore off his garments above the belt, flung them on the sticky floor. They threw him face downward on the long table and began to lash him with a one-piece steel fishing rod. Each stroke cut into the flesh of his back, and they beat him slowly, relishing it, to keep him from fainting too quickly. But he was unconscious when, to the guard's great diversion, the castor oil took effect. Indeed, he did not know it till he found himself limp on a messy piece of gunny sacking on the floor of his cell. They awakened him twice during the night to demand, "You're a communist, eh? You better admit it. We're gonna beat the living tar out of you till you do." Though he was sicker than he had ever been in his life, yet he was also angrier. Too angry to admit anything whatever, even to save his wrecked life. He simply snarled, "No." But on the third beating, he savagely wondered if "no" was now a truthful answer. After each questioning, he was pounded again with fists, but not lashed with the steel rod, because the headquarters doctor had forbidden it. He was a sporty-looking young doctor in plus fours. He yawned at the guards in the blood-reeking cellar. "Better cut out the lashes, or this blank will pass out on you." Doremus raised his head from the table to gasp, "You call yourself a doctor? And you associate with these murderers?" "Oh, shut up, you little blank. Dirty traitors like you deserve to be beaten to death, and maybe you will be, but I think the boys ought to save you for the trial." The doctor showed his scientific mettle by twisting Doremus's ear till it felt as though it were torn off, chuckled, "Go to it, boys," and ambled away, ostentatiously humming. For 3 nights he was questioned and lashed. Once, late at night, by guards who complained of the inhuman callousness of their officers in making them work so late. They amused themselves by using an old harness strap with a buckle on it to beat him. He almost broke down when the examining ensign declared that Buck Titus had confessed their illegal propaganda and narrated so many details of the work that Doremus could almost have believed in the confession. He did not listen. He told himself, "No. Buck would die before he'd confess anything. It's all Aris Dilly's spying." The ensign cooed, "Now, if you'll just have the sense to copy your friend Titus and tell us who's in the conspiracy besides him and you and Wilgus and Webb, we'll let you go. We know, all right. Oh, we know the whole plot. But we just want to find out whether you've finally come to your senses and been converted, my little friend. Now, who else was there? Just give us their names. We'll let you go. Or would you like the castor oil and the whip again?" Doremus did not answer. 10 lashes, said the ensign. He was chased out for half an hour's walk on the campus every afternoon, probably because he would have preferred lying on his hard cot, trying to keep still enough so that his heart would stop its deathly hammering. Half a hundred prisoners marched there, round and round, senselessly. He passed Buck Titus. To salute him would have meant a blow from the guards. They greeted each other with quick eyelids, and when he saw those untroubled spaniel eyes, Doremus knew that Buck had not squealed. And in the exercise yard he saw Dan Wilgus, but Dan was not walking free. He was led out from the torture rooms by guards, and with his crushed nose, his flattened ear, he looked as though he had been pounded by a prize fighter. He seemed partly paralyzed. Doremus tried to get information about Dan from a guard in his cell corridor. The guard, a handsome, clear-cheeked young man, noted in a valley of the White Mountains as a local beau and very kind to his mother, laughed. Oh, your friend Wilgus? That chump thinks he can lick his weight in wildcats. I hear he always tries to soak the guards. They'll take that out of him, all right. Doremus thought, that night, he could not be sure, but he thought he heard Dan wailing half the night. Next morning he was told that Dan, who had always been so disgusted when he had had to set up the news of a weakling's suicide, had hanged himself in his cell. Then, unexpectedly, Doremus was taken into a room, this time reasonably large, a former English classroom turned into a court, for his trial. But it was not District Commissioner Francis Tasbrough who was on the bench, nor any military judge, but no less a protector of the people than the great new provincial commissioner Effingham Swan. Swan was looking at Doremus's article about him as Doremus was led up to stand before the bench. He spoke, and this harsh, tired-looking man was no longer the airy Rhodes scholar who had sported with Doremus once like a boy pulling the wings off flies. "Jessup, you plead guilty to seditious activities?" "Why," Doremus looked helplessly about for something in the way of legal counsel. "Commissioner Tasbrough," called Swan. So at last Doremus did see his boyhood playmate. Tasbrough did nothing so commendable as to avoid Doremus's eyes. Indeed, he looked at Doremus directly and most affably as he spoke his piece.
"Your Excellency, it gives me great pain to have to expose this man, Jessup, whom I've known all my life and tried to help, but he always was a smart aleck. He was a laughingstock in Fort Beulah for the way he tried to show off as a great political leader. And when the chief was elected, he was angry because he didn't get any political office, and he went about everywhere trying to disaffect people. I have heard him do so myself."
"That's enough, thanks. County Commissioner Ledoux. Captain Ledoux, is it or is it not true that the man Jessup tried to persuade you to join a violent plot against my person?" But Shad did not look at Doremus as he mumbled, "It's true." Swan crackled, "Gentlemen, I think that that, plus the evidence contained in the prisoner's own manuscript, which I hold here, is sufficient testimony. Prisoner, if it weren't for your age and your damn silly senile weakness, I'd sentence you to 100 lashes, as I do all the other communists like you that threaten the corporate state. As it is, I sentence you to be held in concentration camp at the will of the court, but with a minimum sentence of 17 years. Doremus calculated rapidly. He was 62 now. He would be 79 then. He never would see freedom again. "And in the power of issuing emergency decrees conferred upon me as provincial commissioner, I also sentence you to death by shooting. But I suspend that sentence, though only until such time as you may be caught trying to escape. And I hope you'll have just lots and lots of time in prison, Jessup, to think about how clever you were in this entrancing article you wrote about me, and to remember that any nasty cold morning they may take you out in the rain and shoot you." He ended with a mild suggestion to the guards. "And 20 lashes. 2 minutes later they had forced castor oil down him. He lay trying to bite at the stained wood of the whipping table, and he could hear the whish of the steel fishing rod as a guard playfully tried it out in the air before bringing it down across the criss-cross wounds of his raw back. Chapter 31. As the open prison van approached the concentration camp at Trianon, the last light of afternoon caressed the thick birch and maples and poplars up the pyramid of Mount Faithful. But the grayness swiftly climbed the slope, and all the valley was left in cold shadow. In his seat, the sick Doremus drooped again in listlessness. The prim Georgian buildings of the girls' school, which had been turned into a concentration camp at Trianon, 9 miles north of Fort Beulah, had been worse used than Dartmouth, where whole buildings were reserved for the luxuries of the corpos and their female cousins, all very snotty and parvenu. The Trianon school seemed to have been gouged by a flood. Marble doorsteps had been taken away. One of them now graced the residence of the wife of the superintendent, Mrs. Cowlick, a woman fat, irate, jeweled, religious, and given to announcing that all opponents of the chief were communists and ought to be shot offhand. Windows were smashed. "Hurrah for the chief" had been chalked on brick walls, and other chalked words, each of 4 letters, had been rubbed out, not very thoroughly. The lawns and hollyhock beds were a mess of weeds. The buildings stood on 3 sides of a square. The 4th side and the gaps between buildings were closed with unpainted pine fences topped with strands of barbed wire. Every room except the office of Captain Cowlick, the superintendent — he was as near nothing at all as any man can be who has attained to such honors as being a captain in the quartermaster corps and the head of a prison — was smeared with filth. His office was merely dreary and scented with whiskey, not, like the other rooms, with ammonia. Cowlick was not too ill-natured. He wished that the camp guards, all MMs, would not treat the prisoners viciously, except when they tried to escape. But he was a mild man, much too mild to hurt the feelings of the MMs and perhaps set up inhibitions in their psyches by interfering with their methods of discipline. The poor fellows probably meant well when they lashed noisy inmates for insisting they had committed no crime. And the good Cowlick saved Doremus's life for a while, let him lie for a month in the stuffy hospital and have actual beef in his daily beef stew. The prison doctor, a decayed old drunkard who had had his medical training in the late 80s, and who had been somewhat close to trouble in civil life for having performed too many abortions, was also good-natured enough, when sober, and at last he permitted Doremus to have Dr. Marcus Olmsted in from Fort Beulah. And for the first time in 4 weeks, Doremus had news, any news whatsoever, of the world beyond prison. Where in normal life it would have been agony to wait for 1 hour to know what might be happening to his friends, his family, now for 1 month he had not known whether they were alive or dead. Dr. Olmsted, as guilty as Doremus himself of what the corpos called treason, dared speak to him only a moment, because the prison doctor stayed in the hospital ward all the while, drooling over whip-scarred patients and daubing iodine more or less near their wounds. Olmsted sat on the edge of his cot with its foul blankets, unwashed for months, and muttered rapidly, "Quick, listen, don't talk. Mrs. Jessup and your 2 girls are all right. They're scared, but no signs of their being arrested. Here Lorinda Pike is all right. Your grandson, David, looks fine, though I'm afraid he'll grow up a corpo like all the youngsters. Buck Titus is alive at another concentration camp, the one near Woodstock. Our NU cell at Fort Beulah is doing what it can. No publishing, but we forward information. Get a lot from Julian Falk. Great joke. He's been promoted, MM squad leader now. Mary and Sissy and Father Perifix keep distributing pamphlets from Boston. They helped the Quinn boy, my driver, and me to forward refugees to Canada. Yes, we carry on, about like an oxygen tent for a patient that's dying of pneumonia. It hurts to see you looking like a ghost, Doremus, but you'll pull through. You've got pretty good nerves for a little cuss. That aged-in-the-keg prison doctor is looking this way. Bye." He was not permitted to see Dr. Olmsted again, but it was probably Olmsted's influence that got him when he was dismissed from the hospital, still shaky but well enough to stumble about, a vastly desirable job as sweeper of cells and corridors, cleaner of lavatories and scrubber of toilets, instead of working in the Woods Gang up Mount Faithful, where old men who sank under the weight of logs were said to be hammered to death by guards under the sadistic Ensign Stoit, when Captain Cowlick wasn't looking. It was better, too, than the undesirable idleness of being disciplined in the doghouse, where you lay naked in darkness, and where bad cases were reformed by being kept awake for 48 or even 96 hours. Doremus was a conscientious toilet cleaner. He didn't like the work very much, but he had pride in being able to scrub as skillfully as any professional pearl diver in a Greek lunchroom, and satisfaction in lessening a little the wretchedness of his imprisoned comrades by giving them clean floors. For, he told himself, they were his comrades. He saw that he, who had thought of himself as a capitalist because he could hire and fire, and because theoretically he owned his business, had been as helpless as the most itinerant janitor once it seemed worthwhile to the big business which corporatism represented to get rid of him. Yet he still told himself stoutly that he did not believe in a dictatorship of the proletariat any more than he believed in a dictatorship of the bankers and utility owners. He still insisted that any doctor or preacher, though economically he might be as insecure as the humblest of his flock, who did not feel that he was a little better than they and privileged to enjoy working a little harder, was a rotten doctor or a preacher without grace. He felt that he himself had been a better and more honorable reporter than Doc Itchett, and a thundering sight better student of politics than most of his shopkeeper and farmer and factory worker readers. Yet bourgeois pride was so gone out of him that he was flattered, a little thrilled, when he was universally called Doremus, and not Mr. Jessup by farmer and workman and truck driver and plain hobo. When they thought enough of his courage under beating and his good temper under being crowded with others in a narrow cell, to regard him as almost as good as their own virile selves. Carl Pascal mocked him. "I told you so, Doremus. You'll be a communist yet." "Yes, maybe I will, Carl, after you communists kick out all your false prophets and bellyachers and power drunkards, and all your press agents for the Moscow subway. Well, all right, why don't you join Max Eastman? I hear he's escaped to Mexico and has a whole big, pure Trotskyite communist party of 17 members there." 17? Too many. What I want is mass action by just one member, alone on a hilltop. I'm a great optimist, Carl. I still hope America may someday rise to the standards of Kit Carson. As sweeper and scrubber, Doremus had unusual chances for gossip with other prisoners. He chuckled when he thought of how many of his fellow criminals were acquaintances. Carl Pascal, Henry Veder, his own cousin, Louis Rotenstern, who looked now like a corpse, unforgettingly wounded in his old pride of having become a real American, Cliff Little, the jeweler, who was dying of consumption, Ben Tripper, who had been the jolliest workman in Madary Cole's grist mill, Professor Victor Loveland of the defunct Isaiah College, and Raymond Pridewell, that old Tory who was still so contemptuous of flattery, so clean amid dirt, so hawk-eyed, that the guards were uncomfortable when they beat him. Pascal, the communist, Pridewell, the squire-archy Republican, and Henry Veder, who had never cared a hang about politics, and who had recovered from the first shocks of imprisonment, these three had become intimates because they had more arrogance of utter courage than anyone else in the prison. For home, Doremus shared with five other men a cell 12 feet by 10 and 8 feet high, which a finishing schoolgirl had once considered outrageously confined for one lone young woman. Here they slept in 2 tiers of 3 bunks each. Here they ate, washed, played cards, read, and enjoyed the leisurely contemplation which, as Captain Cowlick preached to them every Sunday morning, was to reform their black souls and turn them into loyal corpos. None of them, certainly not Doremus, complained much. They got used to sleeping in a jelly of tobacco smoke and human stench, to eating stews that always left them nervously hungry, to having no more dignity or freedom than monkeys in a cage, as a man gets used to the indignity of having to endure cancer. Only it left in them a murderous hatred of their oppressors, so that they, men of peace, all of them, would gladly have hanged every corpo, mild or vicious. Doremus understood John Brown much better. His cellmates were Carl Pascal, Henry Veeder, and three men whom he had not known, a Boston architect, a farmhand, and a dope fiend who had once kept questionable restaurants. They had good talk, especially from the dope fiend, who placidly defended crime in a world where the only real crime had been poverty. The worst torture to Doremus, aside from the agony of actual floggings, was the waiting. The waiting. It became a distinct, tangible thing, as individual and real as bread or water. How long would he be in? How long would he be in? Night and day, asleep and waking, he worried it, and by his bunk saw waiting the figure of waiting, a gray, foul ghost. It was like waiting in a filthy station for a late train, not for hours, but for months. Would Swan amuse himself by having Doremus taken out and shot? He could not care much now. He could not picture it any more than he could picture kissing Lorinda, walking through the woods with Buck, playing with David and Foolish, or anything less sensual than the ever derisive visions of roast beef with gravy, of a hot bath, last and richest of luxuries, where their only way of washing, except for a fortnightly shower, was with a dirty shirt dipped in the one basin of cold water for six men. Besides waiting, one other ghost hung about them, the notion of escaping. It was of that, far more than of the beastliness and idiocy of the corpos, that they whispered in the cell at night. When to escape? How to escape? To sneak off through the bushes when they were out with the woods gang? By some magic to cut through the bars on their cell window and drop out and blessedly not be seen by the patrols? To manage to hang on underneath one of the prison trucks and be driven away? A childish fantasy. They longed for escape as hysterically and as often as a politician longs for votes. But they had to discuss it cautiously, for there were stool pigeons all over the prison. This was hard for Doremus to believe. He could not understand a man's betraying his companions, and he did not believe it till, 2 months after Doremus had gone to concentration camp, Clifford Little betrayed to the guards Henry Veeder's plan to escape in a hay wagon. Henry was properly dealt with. Little was released. And Doremus, it may be, suffered over it nearly as much as either of them, sturdily though he tried to argue that Little had tuberculosis, and that the often beatings had bled out his soul. Each prisoner was permitted one visitor a fortnight, and in sequence Doremus saw Emma, Mary, Sissy, David. But always an M.M. was standing 2 feet away, listening, and Doremus had from them nothing more than a fluttering, "We're all fine. We hear Buck is all right. We hear Lorinda is doing fine in her new tea room. Philip writes he is all right." And once came Philip himself, his pompous son, more pompous than ever now as a corpo judge, and very hurt about his father's insane radicalism. Considerably more hurt when Doremus tartly observed that he would much rather have had the dog Foolish for visitor. And there were letters, all censored, worse than useless to a man who had been so glad to hear the living voices of his friends. In the long run, these frustrate visits, these empty letters, made his waiting the more dismal, because they suggested that perhaps he was wrong in his nightly visions. Perhaps the world outside was not so loving and eager and adventurous as he remembered it, but only dreary as his cell. He had little known Carl Pascal, yet now the argumentative Marxian was his nearest friend, his one amusing consolation. Carl could and did prove that the trouble with leaky valves, sour cow pastures, the teaching of calculus, and all novels was their failure to be guided by the writings of Lenin. In his new friendship, Doremus was old maidishly agitated lest Carl be taken out and shot, the recognition usually given to communists. He discovered that he need not worry. Carl had been in jail before. He was the trained agitator for whom Doremus had longed in New Underground days. He had ferreted out so many scandals about the financial and sexual shenanigans of every one of the guards that they were afraid that even while he was being shot he might tattle to the firing squad. They were much more anxious for his good opinion than for that of Captain Cowlick, and they timidly brought him little presents of chewing tobacco and Canadian newspapers, as though they were schoolchildren honeying up to teacher. When Aristilli was transferred from night patrols in Fort Beulah to the position of guard at Trianon, a reward for having given to Shad Ledoux certain information about R.C. Crowley, which cost that banker hundreds of dollars, Aris, that slinker, that able snooper, jumped at the sight of Carl and began to look pious and kind. He had known Carl before. Despite the presence of Stoit, ensign of guards, an ex-cashier who had once enjoyed shooting dogs, and who now, in the blessed escape of corpoism, enjoyed lashing human beings, the camp at Trianon was not so cruel as the district prison at Hanover. But from the dirty window of his cell, Doremus saw horrors enough. One mid-morning, a radiant September morning with the air already savoring the peace of autumn, he saw the firing squad marching out his cousin, Henry Veder, who had recently tried to escape. Henry had been a granite monolith of a man. He had walked like a soldier. He had in his cell been proud of shaving every morning, as once he had done, with a tin basin of water heated on the stove in the kitchen of his old white house up on Mount Terror. Now he stooped, and toward death he walked with dragging feet. His face of a Roman senator was smeared from the cow dung into which they had flung him for his last slumber. As they tramped out through the quadrangle gate, Ensign Stoit, commanding the squad, halted Henry, laughed at him, and calmly kicked him in the groin. They lifted him up. 3 minutes later, Doremus heard a ripple of shots. 3 minutes after that, the squad came back bearing on an old door a twisted clay figure with vacant open eyes. Then Doremus cried aloud. As the bearers slanted the stretcher, the figure rolled to the ground. But one thing worse he was to see through the accursed window. The guards drove in as new prisoners, Julian Falk in torn uniform, and Julian's grandfather, so fragile, so silvery, so bewildered and terrified in his muddied clericals. He saw them kicked across the quadrangle into a building once devoted to instruction in dancing and the more delicate airs for the piano, devoted now to the torture room and the solitary cells. Not for 2 weeks, 2 weeks of waiting that was like ceaseless ache, did he have a chance at exercise hour to speak for a moment to Julian, who muttered, "They caught me writing some inside dope about M.M. Graft. It was to have gone to Sissy. Thank God nothing on it to show who it was for." Julian had passed on, but Doremus had time to see that his eyes were hopeless and that his neat, smallish clerical face was blue-black with bruises. The administration, or so Doremus guessed, decided that Julian, the first spy among the MMs who had been caught in the Fort Beulah region, was too good a subject of sport to be wastefully shot at once. He should be kept for an example. Often Doremus saw the guards kick him across the quadrangle to the whipping room and imagined that he could hear Julian's shrieks afterward. He wasn't even kept in a punishment cell, but in an open barred den on an ordinary corridor, so that passing inmates could peep in and see him, welts across his naked back, huddled on the floor, whimpering like a beaten dog. And Doremus had sight of Julian's grandfather sneaking across the quadrangle, stealing a soggy hunk of bread from a garbage can and fiercely chewing at it. All through September, Doremus worried lest Sissy, with Julian now gone from Fort Beulah, be raped by Shad Ledoux. Shad would leer the while and gloat over his ascent from hired man to irresistible master. Despite his anguish over the Fawkes and Henry Veder and every uncouthest comrade in prison, Doremus was almost recovered from his beatings by late September. He began delightedly to believe that he would live for another 10 years, was slightly ashamed of his delight in the presence of so much agony, but he felt like a young man, and straightway Ensign Stoit was there, 2 or 3 o'clock at night it must have been, yanking Doremus out of his bunk, pulling him to his feet, knocking him down again with so violent a crack in his mouth that Doremus instantly sank again into all his trembling fear, all his inhuman groveling. He was dragged into Captain Cowlick's office. The captain was courtly.
"Mr. Jessup, we have information that you were connected with squad leader Julian Fawkes' treachery. He has, well, to be frank, he's broken down and confessed. Now, you yourself are in no danger whatever of further punishment, if you will just help us. But we really must make a warning of young Mr. Fawkes. And so, if you will tell us all you know about the boy's shocking infidelity to the colors, we shall hold it in your favor. How would you like to have a nice bedroom to sleep in, all by yourself?" A quarter hour later, Doremus was still swearing that he knew nothing whatever of any subversive activities on the part of Julian. Captain Cowlick said, rather testily, "Well, since you refuse to respond to our generosity, I must leave you to Ensign Stoit, I'm afraid. Be gentle with him, Ensign."
"Yes, sir," said the ensign.
The captain wearily trotted out of the room, and Stoit did indeed speak with gentleness, which was a surprise to Doremus, because in the room were 2 of the guards to whom Stoit liked to show off.
"Jessup, you're a man of intelligence. No use your trying to protect this boy, Fawkes, because we've got enough on him to execute him anyway. So it won't be hurting him any if you give us a few more details about his treason, and you'll be doing yourself a good turn."
Doremus said nothing.
"Going to talk?"
Doremus shook his head.
"All right, then. Tillet."
"Yes, sir."
"Bring in the guy that squealed on Jessup."
Doremus expected the guard to fetch Julian, but it was Julian's grandfather who wavered into the room. In the camp quadrangle, Doremus had often seen him trying to preserve the dignity of his frock coat by rubbing at the spots with a wet rag. But in the cells there were no hooks for clothes, and the priestly garment, Mr. Fawkes was a poor man, and it had not been very expensive at best, was grotesquely wrinkled now. He was blinking with sleepiness, and his silver hair was a hurrah's nest. Stoit, he was 30 or so, said cheerfully to the 2 elders,
"Well, now, you boys better stop being naughty and try to get some sense into your mildewed old brains, and then we can all have some decent sleep. Why don't you 2 try to be honest, now that you've each confessed that the other was a traitor?"
"What?" marveled Doremus.
"Sure. Old Fawkes here says you carried his grandson's pieces to the Vermont Vigilance. Come on now, if you'll tell us who published that rag."
"I have confessed nothing. I have nothing to confess," said Mr. Fawkes.
Stoit screamed, "Will you shut up, you old hypocrite?"
Stoit knocked him to the floor, and as Mr. Fawkes weaved dizzily on hands and knees, kicked him in the side with a heavy boot. The other 2 guards were holding back the sputtering Doremus. Stoit jeered at Mr. Fawkes.
"Well, you old bastard, you're on your knees. So let's hear you pray."
"I shall."
In agony, Mr. Fawkes raised his head, dust smeared from the floor, straightened his shoulders, held up trembling hands, and with such sweetness in his voice as Doremus had once heard in it when men were human, he cried,
"Father, thou hast forgiven so long. Forgive them not, but curse them, for they know what they do."
He tumbled forward, and Doremus knew that he would never hear that voice again. In La Voix Littéraire of Paris, the celebrated and genial professor of belles lettres, Guillaume Semy, wrote with his accustomed sympathy, "I do not pretend to any knowledge of politics, and probably what I saw on my fourth journey to the States United this summer of 1938 was mostly on the surface, and cannot be considered a profound analysis of the effects of corpoism, but I assure you that I have never before seen that nation so great, our young and gigantic cousin in the West, in such bounding health and good spirits. I leave it to my economic confrères to explain such dull phenomena as wage scales, and tell only what I saw, which is that the innumerable parades and vast athletic conferences of the Minutemen and the lads and lassies of the Corpo Youth Movement exhibited such rosy, contented faces, such undeviating enthusiasm for their hero, the chief, Monsieur Windrip, that involuntarily I exclaimed, 'Here is a whole nation dipped in the river of youth.' Everywhere in the country was such feverish rebuilding of public edifices and apartment houses for the poor as has never hitherto been known. In Washington, my old colleague, Monsieur le Secretary McGoblin, was so good as to cry in that virile yet cultivated manner of his which is so well known, 'Our enemies maintain that our labor camps are virtual slavery. Come, my old one, you shall see for yourself.' He conducted me by one of the marvelously speedy American automobiles to such a camp near Washington, and having the workers assembled, he put to them frankly, 'Are you low in the heart?' As one man they chorused, 'No,' with a spirit like our own brave soldiers on the ramparts of Verdun. During the full hour we spent there, I was permitted to roam at will, asking such questions as I cared to, through the offices of the interpreter kindly furnished by His Excellency, Monsieur le Docteur McGoblin, and every worker whom I thus approached assured me that never has he been so well fed, so tenderly treated, and so assisted to find an almost poetic interest in his chosen work as in this labor camp, this scientific cooperation for the well-being of all. With a certain temerity, I ventured to demand of Monsieur McGoblin what truth was there in the reports so shamefully circulated, especially, alas, in our beloved France, that in the concentration camps the opponents of corpoism are ill-fed and harshly treated. Monsieur McGoblin explained to me that there are no such things as concentration camps, if that term is to carry any penological significance. They are actually schools in which adults who have unfortunately been misled by the glib prophets of that milk-and-water religion, liberalism, are reconditioned to comprehend the new day of authoritative economic control. In such camps, he assured me, there are actually no guards, but only patient teachers, and men who were once utterly uncomprehending of corpoism and therefore opposed to it are now daily going forth as the most enthusiastic disciples of the chief. Alas, that France and Great Britain should still be thrashing about in the slough of parliamentarianism and so-called democracy, daily sinking deeper into debt and paralysis of industry, because of the cowardice and traditionalism of our liberal leaders, feeble and outmoded men who are afraid to plump for either fascism or communism, who dare not, or who are too power-hungry to cast off outmoded techniques, like the Germans, Americans, Italians, Turks, and other really courageous peoples, and place the sane and scientific control of the all-powerful totalitarian state in the hands of men of resolution." In October, John Polycop, arrested on suspicion of having just possibly helped a refugee to escape, arrived in the Trianon camp, and the first words between him and his friend Carl Pascal were no inquiries about health, but a derisive interchange as though they were continuing a conversation broken only half an hour before. "Well, you old Bolshevik, I told you so. If you communists had joined with me and Norman Thomas to back Frank Roosevelt, we wouldn't be here now." "Rats, why, it's Thomas and Roosevelt that started fascism, I ask you. Now shut up, John, and listen. What was the New Deal but pure fascism? What'd they do to the worker? Look here. No, wait now, listen. Doremus felt at home again and comforted, though he did also feel that Foolish probably had more constructive economic wisdom than John Polycop, Carl Paschal, Herbert Hoover, Buzz Windrip, Lee Saracen, and himself put together. Or if not, Foolish had the sense to conceal his lack of wisdom by pretending that he could not speak English. Chadledieu, back in his hotel suite, reflected that he was getting a dirty deal. He had been responsible for sending more traitors to concentration camps than any other county commissioner in the province, yet he had not been promoted. It was late. He was just back from a dinner given by Francis Tasbrough in honor of Provincial Commissioner Swan and a board consisting of Judge Philip Jessop, Director of Education Owen J. Peasley, and Brigadier Kippersley, who were investigating the ability of Vermont to pay more taxes. Shad felt discontented. All those damned snobs trying to show off, talking at dinner about this bum show in New York, this first corpo review, Colin Stalin, written by Lee Saracen and Hector McGoblin. How those nuts had put on the agony about corpo art and drama freed from Jewish suggestiveness and the pure line of Anglo-Saxon sculpture, and even, by God, about corporate physics. Simply trying to show off. And they had paid no attention to Shad when he had told his funny story about the stuck-up preacher in Fort Beulah, one Falk, who had been so jealous because the MMs drilled on Sunday morning instead of going to his gospel shop that he had tried to get his grandson to make up lies about the MMs, and whom Shad had amusingly arrested right in his own church. Not paid one bit of attention to him, even though he had carefully read all through the chief's zero hour so he could quote it, and though he had been careful to be refined in his table manners and to stick out his little finger when he drank from a glass. He was lonely. The fellows he had once best known in pool room and barber shop seemed frightened of him now, and the dirty snobs like Tasbrough still ignored him. He was lonely for Sissy Jessop. Since her dad had been sent to Trianon, Shad didn't seem able to get her to come around to his rooms, even though he was the county commissioner and she was nothing now but the busted daughter of a criminal. And he was crazy about her. Why, he'd be almost willing to marry her if he couldn't get her any other way. But when he had hinted as much, or almost as much, she had just laughed at him, the dirty little snob. He had thought, when he was a hired man, that there was a lot more fun in being rich and famous. He didn't feel one bit different than he had then. Funny. Chapter 32. Dr. Lionel Adams, B.A. of Yale, Ph.D. of Chicago, Negro, had been a journalist, American consul in Africa, and, at the time of Berzelius Windrip's election, professor of anthropology in Howard University. As with all his colleagues, his professorship was taken over by a most worthy and needy white man, whose training in anthropology had been as photographer on one expedition to Yucatan. In the dissension between the Booker Washington school of Negroes who counseled patience in the new subjection of the Negroes to slavery, and the radicals who demanded that they join the communists and struggle for the economic freedom of all, white or black, Professor Adams took the mild Fabian former position. He went over the country preaching to his people that they must be realistic and make what future they could. Not in some utopian fantasy, but on the inescapable basis of the ban against them. Near Burlington, Vermont, there is a small colony of Negroes, truck farmers, gardeners, houseworkers, mostly descended from slaves who, before the Civil War, escaped to Canada by the Underground Railway conducted by such zealots as Truman Webb's grandfather, but who sufficiently loved the land of their forcible adoption to return to America after the war. From the colony had gone to the great cities young colored people who, before the corpo emancipation, had been nurses, doctors, merchants, officials. This colony Professor Adams addressed, bidding the young colored rebels to seek improvement within their own souls rather than in mere social superiority. As he was in person unknown to this Burlington colony, Captain Oscar Ledoux, nicknamed Shad, was summoned to censor the lecture. He sat hulked down in a chair at the back of the hall. Aside from addresses by MM officers and moral inspiration by his teachers in grammar school, it was the first lecture he had ever heard in his life, and he didn't think much of it. He was irritated that this stuck-up nigger didn't spiel like the characters of Octavius Roy Cohen, one of Shad's favorite authors, but had the nerve to try to sling English just as good as Shad himself. It was more irritating that the loud-mouthed pup should look so much like a bronze statue. And finally, it was simply more than a guy could stand that the big bum should be wearing a tuxedo. So when Adams, as he called himself, claimed that there were good poets and teachers and even doctors and engineers among the niggers, which was plainly an effort to incite folks to rebellion against the government, Shad signaled his squad and arrested Adams in the midst of his lecture, addressing him, "You goddamn dirty, ignorant, stinking nigger. I'm gonna shut your big mouth for you for keeps." Dr. Adams was taken to the Trianon concentration camp. Ensign Stoit thought it would be a good joke on those fresh beggars, almost communists, you might say, Jessup and Pascal, to lodge the nigger right in the same cell with them. But they actually seemed to like Adams, talked to him as though he were white and educated. So Stoit placed him in a solitary cell where he could think over his crime in having bitten the hand that had fed him. The greatest single shock that ever came to the Trianon camp was in November 1938, when there appeared among them as the newest prisoner, Shad Ledoux. It was he who was responsible for nearly half of them being there. The prisoners whispered that he had been arrested on charges by Francis Tasbrough, officially for having grafted on shopkeepers, unofficially for having failed to share enough of the graft with Tasbrough. But such cloudy causes were less discussed than the question of how they would murder Shad now they had him safe. All Minutemen who were under discipline, except only such Reds as Julian Falk, were privileged prisoners in the concentration camps. They were safeguarded against the common, i.e. criminal, i.e. political, inmates, and most of them, once reformed, were returned to the MM ranks, with a greatly improved knowledge of how to flog malcontents. Shad was housed by himself in a single cell like a not-too-bad hall bedroom, and every evening he was permitted to spend 2 hours in the officers' mess room. The scum could not get at him because his exercise hour was at a time different from theirs. Doremus begged the plotters against Shad to restrain themselves. "Good Lord, Doremus, do you mean that after the sure enough battles we've gone through, you're still a bourgeois pacifist? That you still believe in the sanctity of a lump of hog meat like Ledoux?" demanded Carl Pascal. "Well, yes, I do, a little. I know that Shad came from a family of 12 underfed brats up on Mount Terror, not much chance. But more important than that, I don't believe in individual assassination as an effective means of fighting despotism. The blood of the tyrants is the seed of the massacre, and are you taking a cue from me and quoting sound doctrine when it's the time for a little liquidation?" said Carl. "This one tyrant's going to lose a lot of blood." The Pascal, whom Doremus had considered as, at his most violent, only a gas bag, looked at him with a stare in which all friendliness was frozen. Carl demanded of his cellmates, a different set now than at Doremus's arrival, "Shall we get rid of this typhus germ, Ledoux?" John Polycop, Truman Webb, the surgeon, the carpenter, each of them nodded, slowly, without feeling. At exercise hour, the discipline of the men marching out to the quadrangle was broken when one prisoner stumbled with a cry, knocked over another man, and loudly apologized, just at the barred entrance of Shad Ledoux's cell. The accident made a knot collect before the cell. Doremus, on the edge of it, saw Shad looking out, his wide face blank with fear. Someone, somehow, had lighted and thrown into Shad's cell a large wad of waste soaked with gasoline. It caught the thin wallboard which divided Shad's cell from the next. The whole room looked presently like the firebox of a furnace. Shad was screaming as he beat at his sleeves, his shoulders. Doremus remembered the scream of a horse clawed by wolves in the far north. When they got Shad out, he was dead. He had no face at all. Captain Cowlick was deposed as superintendent of the camp and vanished to the insignificance whence he had come. He was succeeded by Shad's friend, the belligerent snake Tizra, now a battalion leader. His first executive act was to have all the 200 inmates drawn up in the quadrangle and to announce, "I'm not going to tell you guys anything about how I'm going to feed you or sleep you till I've finished putting the fear of God into every one of you murderers." There were offers of complete pardon for anyone who would betray the man who had thrown the burning waste into Shad's cell. It was followed by enthusiastic private offers from the prisoners that anyone who did thus tattle would not live to get out. So, as Doremus had guessed, they all suffered more than Shad's death had been worth. And to him, thinking of Sissy, thinking of Shad's testimony at Hanover, it had been worth a great deal. It had been very precious and lovely. A court of special inquiry was convened, with Provincial Commissioner Effingham Swan himself presiding. He was very busy with all bad works. He used aeroplanes to be about them. 10 prisoners, 1 out of every 20 in the camp, were chosen by lot and shot summarily. Among them was Professor Victor Loveland, who, for all his rags and scars, was neatly academic to the last, with his eyeglasses and his slick tow-colored hair parted in the middle, as he looked at the firing squad. Suspects like Julian Falk were beaten more often, kept longer in those cells in which one could not stand, sit, nor lie. Then, for 2 weeks in December, all visitors and all letters were forbidden, and newly arrived prisoners were shut off by themselves, and the cellmates, like boys in a dormitory, would sit up till midnight in whispered discussion as to whether this was more vengeance by Snake Tizra, or whether something was happening in the world outside that was too disturbing for the prisoners to know. Chapter 33.